Welcome to MacGuffin Man. Very special episode of the MacGuffin Man, in that we'll be breaking down very special episodes of our favorite TV shows, starting with Ellen.
The Jens?
No, I'm just kidding. It's our 100th episode, everybody.
I know. Everyone who's been doing Century Club to the release of our podcast.
You can finally stop.
Congratulations. You can stop, and you never got drunk.
Yeah. Anyways, just before we get to the I don't know if we can call it the meat and potatoes of this podcast, because I guess it's the meat and potatoes of this podcast, but they're less meaty and less potato-y than most podcasts. But we want you to check out our website, themacguffinmen.com. We've got a lot of good content. We're only giving you clips of older shows here, but we've got a total of 100 previous shows to check out.
99.
Yeah, and there are some episodes that we didn't pull clips from because we feel like the whole thing is good and it's definitely worth checking out. But yeah, be sure to check out our website, themacguffinmen.com. Subscribe to us on iTunes. Search for The MacGuffin Men, all one word. And if you like our podcast, be sure to rate us as well. We would appreciate 5 stars. We really can't control you that way. But people rating our podcast helps people to find us, and we really like the idea of people listening to us. And also, we sort of designed this podcast as sort of a good way to get new listeners. So if you have somebody that, you know, has a lot of podcasts that they don't listen to, and they're on the fence about checking out another one, if you can talk them into one episode, maybe give them this episode, because it'll give them our greatest hits, more or less. Also follow us on Twitter at The MacGuffin Men. All one word, no underscores, nothing like that. We tweet out links to our own work, some jokes, and some updates on the podcast, like what our upcoming topics are and stuff like that. Speaking of upcoming topics, next Tuesday is Skyfall. And this past Tuesday we talked about Wreck-It Ralph. Okay. And we have a contest going on right now.
Contest.
You may remember that in the Mighty Ducks episode, I believe we started with the contest where we mentioned that if you could point out or the name of a camera technique where two different planes are in focus at the same time, we would send you a signed copy, signed by us, not by the person it's about, of the Tony Hawk Pro Skater Guide 4 Bally Games instruction manual or strategy guide.
But that question was lame.
No, that question was, I don't want to have to pay the postage because I don't see you enough that we can't split it. It's going to be really expensive because it's so cool, because the postage, Canada Post charges by coolness now, not by weight. It's a new initiative that they've stepped up now that nobody uses the mail.
That's why they wouldn't mail me. That's off the charts.
Yeah, exactly. Anyway, so we've decided to make the question a bit easier so that people have an opportunity to win. Email us at themacguffinmen@gmail.com. If you can identify the movie from which the music we use for our theme song today, if you can tell us what movie that is, then you will get this strategy guide signed by both
Skyfall!
Of us. mail to your house. We'll be back after the theme song.
Welcome to the MacGuffin Men. This episode is brought to you by the MacGuffin Men. Look, it's our 100th episode. We can do whatever the hell we want. Deal with it. And now, here are Alex and James.
All right, welcome back from the mystery theme song that's totally kick-ass.
Skyfall!
Okay.
It's not Skyfall.
You just eliminated a possible answer.
Oh, it really narrows it down.
Yeah. Okay, so it's our 100th episode, James.
Fact. True.
Okay. My question to you...
100.
Shut up. Because I had to skim through I skimmed through the majority of our podcasts, except for like American Beauty and Fight Club, which were our very argumentative podcasts that actually, when I was editing them, they drove me crazy because I was still angry at you. But
you know what? You know what? You're right. You're right about everything.
Shut up.
Now that I think about it,
Now that I think about all the things instantly.
You're right.
Yeah, okay.
You're right, Alex.
Shut up. Anyway. So I was skimming through the majority of our podcasts, and I guess everything past 50, starting with our David Fincher podcast in last December. I found myself sort of disagreeing with things I said sometimes, or sort of like wanting to, want to have a conversation with myself 6 months ago about a point that I made that I don't totally agree with anymore. And I just sort of found it.
Welcome to my world.
Shut up.
Listening to you ramble on.
Oh my God.
Your nonsense.
Oh, Tyler Durden has a nice jacket.
And so I was just wondering why we still do a podcast, and because I do enjoy doing our podcast.
People in my life are wondering that.
Shut up. I enjoy doing this podcast, and I realized the reason I like doing this podcast, outside of the fact that I find the recording process fun. I really like hitting record buttons. I enjoy the idea that there's sort of all of these records of our thoughts at a specific time. I might not agree with everything I've said 6 months ago, but I like that I have a record of me saying these things. And I was wondering what your feelings are about continuing to do this podcast, like sort of, I guess, what you like about it and why you continue to put up with all of my texts saying, hey, are you ready for this podcast today?
I consider it my ongoing film education.
Okay. Yeah, that's fair.
Because I don't know if I would have, like, I always assumed I would have seen Breakfast Club one day and all those 80s movies.
Yeah.
But I don't know when I would have. And I like watching them in a row and figuring out, you know, what they have to offer and why they were so popular. And, you know, just researching them and seeing how much those movies, and I'm kind of talking about everything in general, mean to people, and why that's the case.
Yeah, and I mean, we've always been very interested in movies. I've said this before. I feel like our friendship is based on the fact that we enjoy a few of the same movies.
Fight Club.
I was thinking American Beauty, actually.
American Fight Club. Beautiful American Fight Club.
I prefer American Beauty, : the Fight Club for Suburbia. I don't know where I was leading anymore, but no, I've always been super interested in film. It's the thing about life I'm the most interested in, which, you know, be sad about that or whatever, hate society, hate me in society, whatever you want. I like having a reason to research movies, and I like having a reason to watch the same film a couple times. And going back to your point, I think, I think once you get to a certain age, you get to a point where you're probably not going to see The Breakfast Club, you know, if you're 25 and you haven't seen The Breakfast Club, you know,
yeah.
You might come across it, but you're not, and you're also not going to watch it possibly in the way that you should. I like having a reason to talk about movies, even if not a lot of people listen. I like that we put out a podcast that I think is quality and a podcast that I enjoy the process of making.
But. And I like being a dick to other people about movies, having researched and discussed them already.
Yeah. Yeah. Don't we all, though? Don't we all like sounding superior?
Yep.
You mentioned The Breakfast Club, and one of the first, or well, the specifically the first clip that we're gonna play for you is about Easy A, or from our Easy A podcast. Which was a podcast I really liked. Did you have any favorite podcasts that really stuck out in your head?
A Mighty Ducks.
Yeah, that was, people really... We won't be getting any clips from that because that whole episode was hard to break up into clips. Excuse me. But it's very... It's our most well-reviewed podcast. So
yeah.
Definitely check it out.
I like State of Play.
Yeah, okay. That was good, too. Yeah. Yeah, I remembered our Fincher podcast being really good and really well-researched, and turns out it was. That was when we had to delay for a week, so I think that's part of why it was so well-researched, but we both seemed to put in work on that one. But no, I liked more of them than I thought I would going back, because I don't like the process of listening to these again.
You're a really good salesman, by the way.
No, not because I don't like the content, because, you know, it's my... It, I don't know, to have your own podcast implies that you like the sound of your own voice. I like having something to talk about into a microphone. I don't like listening to that conversation again. You know what I mean? I like the idea of other people listening to it. Anyway, I want other people to love the sound of my voice.
I hate it. but the idea of someone listening to it really does it for me.
Anyways, talking about Easy A, and we sort of mentioned how it fits in with teen movies of decades previous, from the 90s and from the 80s, and also from the earlier 2000s as well. And it was a good podcast, but this is probably the best part of it. So enjoy.
Like, you sort of compared this to other 90s comedies?
Yeah, a little bit, yeah.
Oh, and teen comedies specifically, you meant, right?
Yeah.
Is there a big divide between 80s and 90s teen comedy, more so than there is between, like, 90s and 2000s, or 70s and 80s even?
I wouldn't know anything about 70s teen movies, because, I mean, as far as I know, the common perception is that John Hughes kind of invented it. Like, there were movies about teens before that, but the teen movie we know now was invented by John Hughes in the 80s.
Right, and when people say 80s teen movies,
they mean specifically John Hughes movies.
Yeah, and even, I don't know, listen to our John Hughes podcast if you want to hear more thoughts on this. But,
yeah.
Even the ones that aren't specifically John Hughes, a lot of them really get lumped in because he was so influential, and even some John Hughes stuff isn't, and in a way is not considered like a John Hughes canon movie in a way, like the way Home Alone's not a John Hughes movie, even though it's totally a John Hughes movie.
Yeah. Yeah, no, exactly. No, I totally know what you mean.
And I just think it's, it has to be mentioned because of all the references to 80s movies.
No,
even when they're very specific in this film, and some of them are a little more subtle. Some of them are very, very obvious.
Yeah. Well, here's what I think about the divide between the teen movies in, let's say, the 80s, the 90s, and then the 2000s. Okay. When, let's say, like, I know Easy A came out in 2010, but let's say it's the last teen movie of the 2000s, you know? Which I guess it kind of is. But, okay, so the 80s teen movies really set out the archetypes, like, in The Breakfast Club, you've got the brain, you've got Emilio the wrestler, who's the jock, you've got the Molly Ringwald. Pardon?
The punch dancer.
Yeah, the punch dancer. but I mean, Anthony Michael Hall's character, Brian, really spells that all out at the end of the movie in a shockingly short essay to the principal. And it's just sort of like these became the types that were present in every teen movie, and in basically every narrative media for teens. And other John Hughes movies sort of built on that. Others were more interesting, even more interesting, like Ferris Bueller. Then the 90s teen movies came along and just sort of took, like, the comedy aspect of the movie. It seems like people that made 90s teen movies watched 16 Candles a lot and just sort of stopped there, because 16 Candles is the John Hughes movie that's the most of a sort of straight ahead comedy. And it doesn't get too out of control like Ferris Bueller does, where it just sort of stops being believable. But it's just sort of like a house party movie, and pretty much every teen movie from the 90s that's worth remembering is mostly a house party. You know, I guess I'm specifically thinking of Can't Hardly Wait, but
yeah. But it's, you're right though, because it's, if your quintessential 90s teen movie isn't Can't Hardly Wait, it's American Pie.
Yep. Yeah, that's right.
That's not so ten fine to one party scene.
Yeah,
I think I prefer 10 Things I Hate About You, but I think more people would agree that it's American Pie.
Okay. I don't know. Just from people I've talked to, I feel like it's closer than you think.
Okay.
Yeah. But I actually haven't seen American Pie since like the year 2000, so I really don't remember it at all.
Okay.
Is that the one where Jason Biggs sticks his dick in a pie?
That's the one. I think that's the one where Stifler hits on chicks.
Oh, okay. Cool. Does he call anybody shipwreck? But no, and then in the 2000s, and I mean, again, the those character archetypes from the 80s are very much present in the teen movies. I mean, I'll just break down Can't Hardly Wait really quick. Like, you've got the brain, who's Ethan Embry's character. You've got Trip McNeely, who is Emilio Estevez 3 years out of college. And you've got Peter Facinelli, his character, whose name I forget. Oh, Mike Dexter. He's the jock, the Emilio in high school. and just all, it's really easy to break those down. And same with 10 Things I Hate About You, and I assume American Pie as well. And in the 2000s is where you sort of start to see more playing with those archetypes or trying to do something new with them. Specifically Mean Girls, which we've talked about, really sort of uses those really stereotypical versions of looking at people to sort of comment on how terrible girls are to each other sometimes. And, I don't know, just sort of ends up being more of a comment on high school itself than anything about high school. And I think that's super interesting. A movie that's significantly less good, but still kind of interesting for the way it messes with teen movie tropes is John Tucker Must Die, which came out in 2006. And it's the first like social media teen movie. And, you know, they sort of do character assassination by way of video blogs and basically using AV equipment and the internet to to trash John Tucker. By the way, John Tucker's brother is played by Penn Badgley, who is the Woodchuck Todd in Easy A. But and Easy A, again, is, I think, maybe the most interesting of the three, because, of course, Olive is using technology to set her story straight. It's like, nobody will listen to me. I'm going to trick them into paying attention to me, and then I'm going to, you know, spill my story, which is a really interesting way of telling the story of the movie, and also, I don't know, just sort of tying it all together. I think it's really great.
I think you're right. It gets around the sort of complication or inconsistency of narrating.
Yeah.
Like, since the beginning of time, like, the narration has kind of not made sense.
Okay. Yeah.
You know, you're speaking to someone you don't know who, like, just in the human experience, you're rarely ever speaking to someone where you don't know the audience and you're just saying things like this, you know?
Exactly. Yeah.
And so, this movie could have been done almost exactly the same with probably 4 minutes of different footage, 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Just take out all that webcast stuff and, yep, she's just narrating it the way that we've used to people narrating stories for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
But no, you're right. As far as the narrative function, the webcast makes tons of sense. And it's only at the end that it really works into, you know, the story.
Yeah.
But it does so in a very interesting way. And as you said, it's kind of a trap. Like, she kind of gets them to the webcast on a false pretense.
Mm-hmm.
And
that false pretense basically being a scene out of American Pie and saying that she's going to have sex with Woodchuck Todd on the interwebs.
Yeah. And then very much flips the script. Like, she doesn't have sex with Woodchuck Todd. It's, you know, that's,
maybe she will 5 minutes from now. Maybe she will 5 years from now. Who knows? Maybe she will on their wedding night.
Yeah, but it's, no, I think it's a good little curveball, because not only is it a reversion of one of the most famous scenes of American Pie, which is one of the most famous teen movies.
Yeah.
And, you know, kind of an iconic moment from that movie too.
The second most iconic moment. Yeah.
Yeah, second. Yeah, after, well. But no, it also, just in the social media sense, really reverts, you know, what it is we go to for the internet. Like, we go to see that, you know, whether you think of it as the one side of the spectrum where it's just all the gossip and creeping people do on Facebook.
Yeah.
Or if it's the straight pornography use of the internet.
Yeah, yeah.
It's the reverse of that. Like, mm-hmm, she sells it on that angle, but when you get there, it's a very honest, emotional, upfront telling of what's happened. And it's not the gossip thing. It's not what you've just been hearing from other people. It's, you know, a very explicit, factual recount, setting the story straight account of what she's been through for the past few months or whatever the story is, right?
Yeah. 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 And I think, again, you mentioned that this movie uses clips from old John Hughes movies. Olive explicitly talks about John Hughes movies, and it uses many of the same scenes, or, you know, turns them on their, or changes them a bit. I mean, the last scene combines the end of Can't Buy Me Love, which isn't a John Hughes movie, with the end of The Breakfast Club. Her musical dance sequence, for no apparent reason, is inspired by Ferris Bueller. And another thing that this movie
Say Anything, right?
Pardon?
Say Anything for the
oh yeah, with the when he's standing on top of the lawnmower with the tiny computer speakers.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's Say Anything as well. Yeah, I totally forgot about that.
With the nice little modern twist with the computer speakers.
Yeah.
There's a couple of modern things, like the Facebook jokes and the Googler stuff. Like, it is updated and very, you know, modern.
Exactly. And it's sort of using these old things and then reusing them and adding to them and applying modernity to them, basically. And another way that this is done is throughout the movie, we continually get covers of old songs. Joan Jett's Bad Reputation is covered. Tide Is High. I forget who that song is by, but there's two, I think, two separate covers of that song in this movie. This was another thing that happened in John Tucker Must Die as well. They did a lot of covers of old songs, but so it's even sort of building on things from movies 4 years before it, you know. But I think the way it sort of, it pays tribute to the past and then also is sort of like, well, we're going to play with it as well, you know, like we're going to do our own thing with it. And which is, if that's not a modern way of making a movie, I don't know what is, you know. Great point.
Good point.
Yes. Points were made. They were salient.
That A was so easy.
I know, right? Movies, another couple of movies that we spent a lot of time talking about outside of this podcast and then on this podcast are the Christopher Nolan Batman movies. We've got a couple clips here from our podcast on Batman Begins and The Dark Knight. I talked a little bit about how I feel like Heath Ledger's performance is a hindrance to The Dark Knight as a whole. Which I'd never thought about before the summer and then spent a lot of time thinking about and then talked about it into Americaphone. And you also put forward a point I really enjoyed about why people like superheroes or why the superhero movies have had such a rise. And I thought
not 9/11.
Pardon?
It's not 9/11.
Yeah, I know. It's much more interesting than that. And yeah, I thought it was cool. So let's check it out. Is Heath Ledger's performance in The Dark Knight so good that it's detrimental to the movie as a whole?
Like, it's because distracting?
Sort of. Because here's what I think the movie is about. I feel like the movie, like, I know it's about chaos and all that stuff, but I feel like The Dark Knight is about the creation of a villain. It's Batman Begins is the origin of Batman. The Dark Knight is sort of the origin of a villain. And the Joker is there to make this origin story happen through Harvey Dent.
Origin of Two-Face, not of Joker.
Yeah, sorry, Two-Face. Yeah, no, it's definitely not about the origin of Joker. Like I said, he's more of a plot device than he is really a character.
And don't get an origin story from him. And
exactly.
Christopher Nolan was very deliberate about that. He thought that made him kind of more of an absolute, he said. And, you know, we get conflicting origin stories, neither of which I think we're meant to believe.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's sort of the reason they wanted his origin story to be absolute is because we're getting Two-Face's origin story in this movie. And it's just sort of like the Joker is there to give him a little push. And that's what his last scene about basically insanity is, the Joker's upside down speech. And all he had to do was give Harvey a little push. And it's sort of about this creation of the villain. And the movie is far more about Harvey Dent than it's really ever about the Joker. And it's just sort of like, that's maybe why people feel like the last 10 minutes are tacked on, is because the Joker's out of the movie. We know he's not coming, or we have a good idea that he's done and he's not coming back. Yeah. And it's just sort of like, he's so good that we want him to come back, but it kind of, because people really don't like that stuff with Harvey Dent after the Joker. And I think like the whole movie is about Harvey Dent's creation and where Batman stands in contrast to that. And I mean, I recognize that most of the examination of Batman comes through his contrast to the Joker in this movie as well. But I think it's just more about the creation of the villain and Harvey. We just don't care about Harvey Dent's most villainous scene because of the fact that the Joker is out of the movie and has been arrested.
And Heath Ledger felt good while he was around.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And he's so great. And, like, I can't say enough about how much I love Heath Ledger in this movie, and I am certainly not alone. But, like, I was just thinking about that the last time I watched it. I was like, is this bad for the movie as a whole, how good he is?
Yeah, no, you're right. I didn't even consider that, but, like, it seems like you're kind of exhausted. Like, you've already reached your, you know, villain appreciation peak by the time Two-Face yep. really gets to, like, I mean, his face gets burnt a lot earlier than this, but when he finally seems to have accepted who he is and become his own, he's playing second fiddle to the Joker, and then when the Joker's gone, everyone's, I think, spent.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And again, I like the last 10 minutes of the movie more than most people, but yeah, I was just curious about it.
Oh, that's good. I like that.
Yeah. And I just sort of wonder how the movie, like, say, Heath Ledger's performance is on par with everybody else in the movie, who, like, Christian Bale, Gary Oldman, and Aaron Eckhart, I feel like all give great performances, but, like, you know, not Heath Ledger. And I wonder how the movie would be taken if those performances were all on the same level.
But for this, I was thinking more Batman and just superheroes in general. It's about manipulating the real world and actually having a physical impact on the world around you. And I just think that a lot of people, the way that they socialize, things they do, and a lot of people, just the way they work, like the jobs that they have now, it's so digital and it's all computerized. And, you know, a lot of people have jobs where you go to work and you spend 8 hours, and, you know, I'm not saying your job is useless if this is how you work, because it's that's certainly not what I mean, but you haven't really changed the physical world in any way. Like, you've done something, and again, I don't mean to denigrate people who work like this, like, that's not,
you mean like everybody,
yeah. But, you know, it's, things haven't really physically changed from, you know, a very empirical, tangible perspective. And I think that, you know, part of this fascination, this recent, fascination with superheroes, is to see the world in that physical way again. And, you know, comic books have always been, superhero comic books have always been, you know, a power fantasy. You know, kids are, you know, sort of weak and powerless, and then they look up to this, you know, big adult who can, you know, change the world and, you know, move very heavy objects and all these, you know, things that they're physically limited against. And I think now so many people spend so much time in the digital realm that it is, you know, very exhilarating to be reminded that there is a, you know, a brick and mortar world out there that can be changed and demolished and burnt and destroyed or rescued, you know? And I just think that we're getting so far away from the physical world and, you know, impacting it in any meaningful way in our day-to-day lives, that to be reminded of it and to see it, you know, manipulated in this way, I think affects people in a way that they don't get affected very often. And that's just, I think part of the recent superhero explosion is, you know, definitely we have the technology to do it now, but at the same time, that technology is preventing us from really, you know, manifesting our beliefs in the physical world. So
yeah,
that's all.
Okay. so what you're saying is that in your job, where my understanding of it is you do some manual labor.
Yes.
Do you feel like Batman?
All the time.
Another movie we talked about.
That man was such a bat.
Yeah, right? Craziness. Another movie we talked about that was a podcast that I was very happy to do because I love watching this movie a lot, is The Graduate. And you enjoyed it.
Feeny!
In case you were curious, that podcast did have a Feeny call in it. We did our job correctly.
Good.
One. Yeah. Anyway, that was a good podcast as well. I enjoyed listening to it and as a whole. But yeah, here is a bit that we sort of try and break down what Elaine means to the film.
I know you've read The Rebel Cell.
Yes.
And their dissection of American Beauty.
Yeah.
And how he says it's kind of a trope and that there's a lot of movies that do this. But it's a movie that kind of pretends to be about getting free, but is, and, you know, making your own decisions, but it's more about reverting to adolescence.
Yeah.
Do you see this kind of in the same vein?
No.
Okay. And why not then?
And I mean, I haven't read The Rebel Cell in like 5-6 years, so as it pertains to the movie, like what you just said, I think it sort of shows somebody, it initially shows somebody that wants to revert, like wants to go backwards. We talked about that.
Benjamin, but yeah. Not Elaine.
Yeah. Yeah, the movie really doesn't focus much on Elaine. Again, she's more of an object than a person.
Yeah.
And again, I apologize to our female listeners. Yeah, he wants to revert, but he does end up, you know, about halfway through the movie, he ends up wanting to be an adult. He realizes that he sort of wants to move forward. My take on the end of the movie is, like, he's got his Elaine, he's got the thing that he wants, and he just really hopes he's right. And okay. It's sort of this about that being what he wants with his life. And, you know, it sort of speaks to this whole, this doubt, like, if you're sort of embarking on something totally new, I mean, always, once you're smart enough to doubt things, you're going to be like, okay, I hope this is the right decision I'm making. And I mean, you really won't know until time passes. And I like that about it.
Okay.
Yeah, that's sort of my take. I don't think it's about reversion. I think it's about moving forward.
Okay.
And I think it's about the confusion of moving forward.
Okay.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
See, I don't know. I see it as the reversion thing a little bit more. I think he kind of just has it in his head that there's all this pressure for him to grow up. When are you going to make a decision? When are you going to decide where your life wants to go? I think that Elaine comes along. We don't see that much of their relationship being great.
No, not at all.
Yeah, we see that they're able to talk to each other, but...
It's really just that one date.
Exactly. Yeah. It, there could be more, but what we see is just...
It's implied that they're... Oh, is it the second date when Mrs. Robinson sort of beats Elaine to the car? And
Yeah, because okay. That's the very next day after their first date.
Yeah.
I think he... You know, we don't see much of this going that well. I think he sees this one date and really latches onto it and says, this is it. This is what I'm going to do. This is my direction.
Yep.
And it's not so much about what the actual goal is. It's about having a goal for the first time in a long time. And it's a goal that he's chosen for himself. And I think that's, you know, organic and useful for him. It wasn't Mr. Feeney saying, marry this woman, even though he's all for it. I think he makes a decision that, you know, this is the person I want. That's going to be my goal. I'm going to get it. And gets more focused on having a goal and, you know, obtaining it, as we've said. Mm-hmm. Again, sorry, ladies. and, you know, when he gets it, and I think it's summed up very well in the end, I think it is a complete reversion. I think that when they're on the back of the bus and they stop laughing, they realize, like, okay, we've done this. We've achieved this goal, and now we have, whatever, 60 years together, mm-hmm. and we don't know if they're going to be any good. And to me, again, probably reading too much into things, but...
You can never.
It seems like they're the cool kids at the back of the bus, the back of the school bus. Mm-hmm. They're, you know, the grade eights who think they have things all figured out, and they really don't.
Well, they are that momentarily, but the difference is that they figure out that they don't.
yeah. But yeah, I think that, I don't know, I think his whole pursuit of her is very short-sighted, and it's more about having a goal than what the actual goal is.
I agree with that. Okay. I'm just sort of taking it from the idea that, I mean, there's always the chance it could work out.
Yeah,
that's true. I think them being worried is... totally okay.
Yeah, no. I just think they have a lot to be worried about.
I think,
and it's a small chance it works out with what they've established.
That they are worried shows that that they are adults. Yeah. The Last Waltz is another movie we talked about.
True. 100.
Again, thank you to John Alistair, one of our biggest fans, for suggesting that topic because it ended up being a pretty decent podcast. Johnny Shapes, is that his name?
He has a jazz fusion band called Johnny Shapes and the Chaos.
Okay.
No, he doesn't actually, but we've talked about it.
I assume that wasn't true, but anyway, yeah, we talked about The Last Waltz, and you made some points about how autumnal the color scheme in the movie was, and how the movie is sort of about how you thought the movie was sort of about death in a way, death of a music scene, death of the band, I guess, not a literal sense, but, yeah. And I also,
it's not a literal band.
and then since I care more about hip hop than I do about, rock music, I tried to find a way to compare the band to Jay-Z, And I did that, and you will listen to it after you hear about James talk about the fall or autumn.
Right. Well, yeah, I was trying to notice the colors, and I saw like lots of oranges and yellows, but yeah, tons of orange. And then I was reading some people's reviews of it, and they said that kind of gives it an autumn fall kind of feel.
Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, that's fair.
And I do see that in those 70s colors we described do just happen to be that kind of autumn color palette too.
Yeah.
And this person was who I noticed used the word, you know, autumnal to describe the colors, was talking about how this movie is sort of about death and how, you know, when we get that, you know, big scheme of like spring is birth and then summer is life and then fall is always kind of as you're dying, like winter's death and fall is, you know, the end of things.
Uh-huh.
And this movie is about their farewell show. They've had 16 years on the road, and a lot of the interviews are looking back on, you know, how we got our name, all these kinds of things that have happened in the past. And
it took place in late fall too. So,
okay. Yeah. And it's just kind of a very, you know, past looking movie. Right.
Yep.
Do you see that this is a lot about death? I mean, they don't do anything else after this.
I think that's,
and they end with
that conversation about dead rock stars, basically.
Dead rock stars. I Shall Be Released is always more pleasant sounding than I think it really is.
I see that now. I've never seen that before, but I think that's 100% right.
Yeah, and they talk a lot about, you know, fame and trying to last and things like that. And I think even right off the bat, what's the pool game that they're playing right at the start?
Cutthroat.
Yeah, which is all about knocking everybody else's balls off the table and being the last one, and it's just kind of just about surviving. And as you said, this has a lot of black in it. Like, it is very literally a dark movie. Yeah. And but I do think that a lot of the interviews and a lot of the even just the songs are a lot about, you know, the end of things and death and things being over.
Plus, it makes you look at Neil Diamond for 5 minutes. So that's just depressing.
So I'm happy.
Fade to Black was this documentary, came out in 2004, I think. Jay-Z, a documentary on Jay-Z's, you know, quote unquote, final performance when he retired and then before he came back. It was, the idea was this concert was in Madison Square Garden. It was his final performance.
He's from New York.
Yeah, yeah. From our city, Madison Square. It was less than a week after the Black Album came out, which was supposed to be his final album. And it's basically the last one, because I know nobody listening to this has seen this movie. Even Jay-Z fans haven't seen this movie. I know one other person that has watched this movie, and I haven't talked to him in 6 years.
I just love your blanket statements.
Well, no. Continue. Okay, we know everybody that listens to this podcast, and I know that none of them have seen this movie. And even I'm not going to try and talk somebody into it. It's basically, it's the last waltz. If you switch out the, you know, there's more focus on the audience, and you switch out the interview portions with the band to sort of a small documentary on the making of the Black Album, Jay-Z in the studio and stuff like that. He's on Shangri-La, but he's going to Miami to visit Timbaland, which is actually really amazing. You should watch that scene. But
what's his place called?
A studio? I don't know.
Shangri-La-La-La?
That's brutal.
It's a Jay-Z song.
Oh, okay. There it is. Matt Fleek, always smoking the la-la-la.
Is it a hip-hop-umentary? Is that what it's called?
I think the word is rap-umentary. Okay. Yeah, and there's these interesting parallels between the two movies just because of the genres of music. I mean, Jay-Z gets all of his friends on stage. The switch being that all of the band's friends are more famous than them, whereas Jay-Z is more famous than all of his friends, with the exception of Beyonce. And it's this really interesting, because I think when you think of music from around the time period that the band came out of, they really sort of symbolize, you know, you said there's nothing remarkable about their music, but when you hear that music, that's what you think of when you think of that type of music. It's something that sounds like that.
Yeah.
This sort of like classic rock, but, you know, sort of got a little folk to it, that type of thing. And when you think of hip hop around 2003, all you think of is Jay-Z. And the thing I find interesting about the movies and the genres of music as well is there's this weird perception of authenticity in hip hop that is the complete opposite of authenticity in rock music. I feel like rock music authenticity is you play everything live, right? And you know, the band is a very quote unquote authentic band because, you know, they record in this house that's far away from society. It's recorded in Big Pink or whatever this house is, and it's all you know, live instrumentation. Whereas the general, you know, leaving out image, just purely musically, hip hop generally, with the exception of the Roots, and the Roots sort of stand alone, because they're kind of one of a kind in hip hop, but, the authentic music is sampled music generally. Like when you think of, you know, a type of old school, like the type of hip hop that, purists are sort of the most inclined to love, it's very sample based. And around 2003, you sort of, I mean, the Neptunes are rising and they didn't do a lot of sampling. They had their drums and their synthesizers, which sort of started a trend away from sampling, even though Jay-Z had this really great 2001 album called The Blueprint, which sort of brought the sample back and sort of paved the way for Kanye, who built his career on sampling. And I just find just this really interesting difference in between the two genres, and I don't know, just that it's sort of captured in these two different films and
that are so alike.
Pardon?
That are so alike.
Yeah, exactly. And it's just the two genres, their perception of authenticity in their music is just totally flipped. Because if you, when you throw a drum machine on a rock track, it's weird.
Yeah.
It doesn't seem right.
And you're, yeah. And people would make fun of your band for it.
Yeah. And in the same thing where a lot of, rappers or producers that, hip hop producers that use, you know, a lot of keyboards, like Eminem's beats just sound purely synthetic, any beat he makes. And that's why Renegade sort of sticks out from Blueprint and also Ola Ovito and another song that's the Timbaland song, which name, the name I cannot say. And they sort of stick out because they aren't sampled. And it's just, I don't know, it's this weird difference from hip hop to rock music. And I'm really curious about that, and I don't know, I've never figured it out, but I've always found it really interesting. I don't know.
And that's why the Roots are cool, because they straddle the line.
Well, and I don't even know if they, because they sample.
Yeah.
And then they, a lot of times they'll get sent, they'll have someone give them sort of a beat, and then they play it, and then they add their stuff to it. For the majority of their music, they don't use a lot of sampling, but their best songs involve sampling.
Okay.
A lot of their best songs, I should say. Or, and their other best songs sort of involve playing a very type of old school break style hip hop, like Web that I mentioned, 75 Bars, which is really great and has a tuba for a bass line. But otherwise, it's just a break. And, you know, I don't know. It's just this really, I'm infinitely curious about that difference in those types of music. But I don't know.
Cool.
Yeah.
I mean, good points there, us.
You said it.
Maybe you did. We're not listening to this right now. I don't totally remember who the last one to speak was. So, anyway, Jurassic Park was a podcast that there are a lot of good parts in. There's actually, you make a very good point about Jurassic Park as sort of being structured like a theme park ride. That's very good, but it was sort of like way too long for us to put in here, because it spirals into a very long discussion. And that Jurassic Park podcast is a very good episode. Highly recommend it. But here is a discussion you and I had, that's a bit quicker than the roller coaster discussion, about why I thought the ending was weak. And I mean, in general, we sort of disagree about Jurassic Park. I'm sort of, I like to play the devil's advocate when discussing Jurassic Park. Yeah, exactly. That's how most people react. But yeah, no, and here's us discussing. Or I guess me discussing and then James booing me as to why I think the ending is weak.
Last week.
Do you want to talk about the ending?
Yeah, that's a big problem I have with it. This movie doesn't really have a climax.
No.
It has an action sequence that just sort of ends. You know, it doesn't, it's like what is a bigger form of deus ex machina than running, is that how to pronounce it?
I only ever read it. Some people say deus.
Okay, yeah, that would make more sense, I guess, but anyways, you're just sort of running away from raptors and, oh, T-Rex just swoops in, eats them, done.
But oh, sorry, continue.
And the movie's about adapting, right?
Yeah.
And the humans never really adapt to, you know, the situation. I recognize it's a very difficult situation they're in
to live in.
But I think the only satisfying ending is the humans getting away with no help. from a dinosaur. Because if it's all about evolving and then something that's a part of their habitat comes in, stomps it out with the T-Rex, right. I think that's just so deflating, and it just really hammers home that they were just running through this amusement park and just running as fast as they could trying to get through it. They don't really... Like, you know, Sattler turns on the power to the rest of the parks.
And Lexi nerds it up on the computer.
Yeah, with her hacking skills.
Yep.
There's that type of stuff. But as far as the final moment being determined by, you know, not the humans and the people we're supposed to identify with, I don't like it. I think it's a total letdown.
Okay, I think that I agree with almost all of what you said. I think it is absolutely a climax. I think maybe it's a cheap climax.
It is a climax, but it's a climax that's not good.
Okay, yeah, that's fine. I just feel that it's kind of one of the most climactic climaxes ever. With the T-Rex going down, with the banner of When Dinosaurs Ruled the Earth going, with the John Williams score peaking. Yeah. Like, I think that is a climax. I'd agree that, yes, it probably isn't the most deserved climax and is a little deflating, but I think it's climactic for sure. I think it certainly peaks at a point and then, you know, the plot closes down and that's that.
And I think that's sort of my, and there's that really quick epilogue and there's sitting... Ellie has found way to found time to slick back her hair really quick. And I guess that sort of stands to my whole point, is that the reason I don't love this movie the way most people do, particularly now, is that I don't find a lot interesting thematically.
Okay.
And the thing that is interesting about this movie thematically is the evolution idea, these things evolving, and what wins out is the CGI that you're like, luck, and the CGI that you're like, well, think about what you're doing with this stuff first, you know? And I think it's just totally deflating. It's a deflating ending, and
We spent a lot of time talking about David Fincher in our last podcast of 2011. It was a two-parter, both parts, the solid, like, hour and 15 to hour and a half long. Spent a lot of time talking about David Fincher, which I was happy to do. As we both seem to enjoy his work. We did sort of get into an argument about a question we talk about in all of our podcasts, where we talk about a director's body of work. You and I sort of had an argument about whether or not David Fincher is an auteur. And I still disagree with your argument. I assume you still disagree with mine.
No, you're right, man.
Shut up. Well, don't shut up because we're on a podcast. You know what I mean.
I just never saw it that way before. Before I listened to your argument and then waited 6 months.
Anyway, here is that argument about whether or not we think David Fincher is an auteur.
Is he an auteur?
Yes.
The first
question? Oh, God, yes.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
How so?
Well, shall we go through all of the movies?
Sure.
Because I have a point for every movie. I thought this through, and...
It is my first question on all of our auteur casts.
Yeah.
Well, all our director podcasts.
Or do you want to save this for the end, and I'll sort of go through it at the end, or do you have a good any point? Okay, well, fair enough. All right, well, let's look at 7. Two things that Fincher... that is very key to Fincher's aesthetic is sort of a rejection of money, a rejection of commercialism, and also the failing of institutions. Sort of things like, you know, Harvard Law or the police, or, you know, just these things that they have to give up. 7, they never catch the killer. The killer wins. The cops never catch the killer. The killer surrenders. John doesn't control that whole movie. And this sort of, these authority figures that we trust are just incorrect. Like, they don't win.
Yeah.
And they don't even apprehend him. They don't, they basically do nothing. They try, but they fail throughout the whole movie. The game is pretty obvious. It's all about a rejection of money. And you know, the idea that the last shot is his first sort of free choice because he doesn't worry about his money anymore. Which, by the way, did you ever see the intro for Michael Douglas's AFI Lifetime Achievement Award?
No.
He falls.
Oh, I heard about that, though.
I watched a video of it today, and it was really funny.
Just like the end of 7. That's hilarious.
Oh, the end of the game.
Hilarious.
It was really funny.
Good for him.
Yeah. Fight Club, I don't even think I really have to explain this one. They destroy credit card companies, you know, like, it's Fight Club. Panic Room... again, they sort of reject. They're like, oh, we don't need this money. We don't need to spend all of the money that we have. It's just sort of like, let's live within our means. Let's get this, you know, 2-bedroom place. Zodiac, again, I touched on this a lot in the discussion of the movie. It's just sort of Graysmith is the movie's hero, as much as it has one. And he is continuing because cops and journalists give up on the case.
He's just a dude.
Yeah, and he doesn't have to worry about people being like, well, it's no longer financially feasible to cover this or to, you know, try and solve this case because there aren't clues anymore.
Brian Cox.
Yeah, no, he's awesome.
I know.
And Benjamin Button is where there's the least of this. But who is the richest character in Benjamin Button?
Benjamin Button.
Benjamin Button's father. And
well, yeah, but he inherits it all anyway.
Yeah, he does. Yeah, but the person that has that money originally is a bad dad who doesn't take care of his kid, essentially. Like, he gives his kid away immediately. And he's the only person that really has money in that movie. And The Social Network, I mean, it's sort of like all of these things coming to a head in that we see somebody trying to achieve this rich, to become an institution. And Facebook is an institution. Zuckerberg has become an institution.
Yeah.
And at the end of the movie, and he's got all the money he could possibly dream of, more than he probably dreamt of. And he's just unhappy. And I think the institutions thing is very much about Fincher. And I mean, Fincher, the way he talks about his ad work as well, he's like, I've never been a person of commercialism. Like, the commercials I do are art. And I might, you know, there are four companies and I, you know, they are, you know, they are commercial and that they're commercials. But the few commercials of his I've watched, like I showed you that Nike one with Troy Polamalu and LaDainian Tomlinson.
Which is very good.
It's a very good commercial and it's really well staged. And it's sort of like the life of LaDainian Tomlinson, a football running back, and Troy Polamalu is a safety. It's sort of their life until they end up Polamalu tackling LaDainian Tomlinson at the end of the video or at the end of the 1-minute commercial, and like Tomlinson is always on the left side of the screen, Polamalu always on the right, and like all through the scenes, and I like that a lot. It's a good commercial, but and it's sort of like he also uses these things as a testing ground. So it's like he shot Zodiac on digital after he was like, okay, I've used this in enough commercials, I know the limits of this camera, I can trust it in a movie. And I think the big thing as far as Fincher sort of like pushing away from commercialism and particularly institutions is he never went to film school and he doesn't believe in film school, more or less. He says directing, and I have no source for this. This is just an IMDb quote. You don't learn directing in film school. Directing is, directing's not sort of like about drawing and then making that picture happen. You don't know what directing is until you've got 5 hours until the light runs out. Yeah. And it's just sort of like he went to sort of a summer camp of sorts with a friend, like a film summer camp, and everybody's doing all their like pretentious artsy stuff. And he's like, we just want to pull cables. We just want to like work on something. We want to make something happen. And I think I like that a lot about him. And going through these movies again recently, I've always sort of said that Memento has really formed my view on a certain thing in my life. And I think Fincher's movies have had much more of an effect on me than I thought until like this week.
Okay.
So I find that extremely interesting. And I love his aesthetic visually. And, you know, obviously there's visual things throughout the movie, but I think he's more of an auteur than any of the other directors we've talked about.
Okay. See, I don't think that he is. I agree with your point that you can find that in all those movies. I just don't think that that's enough to make you an auteur.
Then what does make you an auteur?
Like just having a more consistent style and not saying your movies have to be repetitive, but I just think that you have to have like a more noticeable trademark on things. I think he does, you know, he does have some themes, and I think visually, you know, his movies are very dark and he does some things a lot. I just don't think he does enough frequently to be an auteur. And I like him tons. It's not that I don't think he's good enough to be an auteur.
Then who do you consider an auteur and what about them makes them an auteur?
Oh, like Woody Allen or what's his name? Royal Tenenbaums.
Anderson. Okay, yeah. So it's visuals.
Not necessarily, but I mean they have those movies are a lot more similar to each other than his movies are to each other.
Okay.
Like I could watch
thematically though, Fincher's movies are all very much very similar.
I don't think so. I think what you brought up is correct, but I don't think that they are enough stuff is similar. And I don't think just themes can be enough to make it. Like, you know, within 5 minutes of watching a Wes Anderson movie that you're watching a Wes Anderson movie.
Yeah, because his style is very, you know, upfront.
Yeah, and I think a lot of the themes and the dialogue and a lot of the music selections and stuff like that, I think, are a lot... Yeah, maybe it's more upfront, but I think that's
it's more obvious auteur-ness. I don't think that necessarily... Like, I like Fincher better. I've been vocal about not particularly caring for the auteur theory in general. because it sort of undermines the whole collaborative thing that film is, which Fincher has talked about. It's sort of like, he says it's a collaborative medium, and because it obviously is. And, like, I'm not sort of just arguing to argue. I just think if Woody Allen and Wes Anderson are auteurs, I think Fincher absolutely is. It's just that Woody Allen and Wes Anderson write their movies, so they're writing about the same thing all the time. Fincher is using different writers.
Yeah.
And Fincher has hired Andrew Kevin Walker to do a rewrite on Panic Room, and they changed Burnham from a gambler to a guy who has family issues. Sort of,
yeah.
That makes the money more of a problem for, you know, more human reasons.
Yeah.
And, you know, and he's hired rewrites, and things have changed about his movies over time that, you know, from when he gets the script, things have changed. To be more into the Fincher aesthetic. I can't think of any other examples off the top of my head, but things have changed. There are a lot of rewrites and stuff that he commissions. So.
One thing I realized I'm sort of obsessed with talking about throughout listening... What?
Yourself.
Yeah, nope. But I knew that one. It was this is something that really struck me when listening to these again. I am obsessed with talking about authenticity. And we're sort of going to end on... Well, our last clip that we've got here is something from our French Connection podcast where we sort of talk about, because that film was sort of shot in a style that was trying to mimic documentaries. And it was a very influential film. And we talk sort of about found footage movies as well, and just sort of the very handheld aesthetic and where it led and where it sort of, and where messing with the facts in the French Connection's actual case, where that sort of starts to become, I don't know, a little questionable morally. But no, it was an interesting discussion. And we're going to play that for you now. I'm a horrible radio host, by the way.
Good thing we don't have a radio show.
I know. It's a podcast. It's totally different.
Oh, based on a true story. Okay. Like, I just had no idea.
But they don't even get it right. Which is the weirdest thing to me. Like, why... do 75% of what really happened and then change the futures of the two cops.
Well, here's the thing about that to me. And throughout the director's commentary, William Friedkin is saying, he's always talking about how authentic the movie is, how they shot in a documentary style. Like, we didn't have permits for anything. We were just rolling Rico Bravo around on a wheelchair to get our dolly shots, you know?
Yeah.
And, or Ricky Bravo, sorry, he calls him.
Rico Bravo's too good.
Yeah. Ricky Bravo's pretty amazing,
yeah,
too.
That's true.
But, yeah, Friedkin's always talking about how, you know, realistic the movie is until they change something about it, in which point he totally backs up and says, look, this is a movie that's about my impressions of the case. That's a quote he uses often. And that's why, that's where the movie is kind of troubling to me, because I think that's too much of a cop-out for me. You can't just be like, well, we're shooting it like a documentary because this is a real story. Except for these parts that I changed.
Yeah.
You know, and like when he's talking about the car chasing train sequence, which did not happen, he's saying, well, and we change it to this because it's a movie and the movie needed a big action scene.
Yeah.
You know, like, and that just doesn't fly with me. You can't talk about the realism of something and then, and how realistic your movie is. And, in his defense, the, techniques and everything, from everything I know about police work, this is a fairly realistic movie to how they're doing surveillance and stuff like that. It glosses over a lot of it and just speeds it up, and there's just quick scenes of them playing cards. But generally, you know, like, Popeye Doyle doesn't act too much out of what I would expect a real cop to do, except when he's, you know, shooting people.
Yeah. that thing.
But yeah, and I just think there's a real problem there where you're talking about all this documentary stuff until you say something that wasn't true, you know? And then you just like, well, I've got this as a defense, you know? And it's sort of going back to the, sticking with the authenticity thing. There's this movie coming out, or that will be out by the time this podcast is out, Act of Valor. Do you know this movie?
That rings a bell. Which one is that?
It's, it is the movie with real, Navy SEALs or whatever.
It's totally fiction, but real Navy SEALs and technology and tactics and stuff, right?
It's based around real acts of valor, which I assume are really heroic things, you know? And the people playing these Marines or SEALs, whatever they are, I apologize to all of our Army listeners.
Yeah.
Gene Hackman, former Marine, by the way. Further backing up my point that he is a man. Anyway.
He's enjoyable.
Love Gene Hackman.
He seems like such a, like, not even a nice person, but like a real human being.
And he's the interview. I'll post the interview on the site that I read. It's a really interesting interview, and he's really reflective now, which I enjoy. But anyways, he's just writing historical fiction now. He's retired as an actor.
Like 4 books with like underwater archaeologist writing partner.
Go for it, man. This movie Act of Valor. It makes me upset. Not even because I have to watch the trailer every time I go see a movie now, and it has been this way for a couple months, but it's basically financed. Isn't it financed by the government now? Because it was made as a training vehicle. It was made as a training video with really high production values, and then they turned it into a movie to be released in the theaters.
That's awesome.
And so these SEALs are playing themselves, doing, you know, and the tactics that they would use in these situations are as close as possible. And I was watching an interview with the directors for this movie that just made me so angry, because they were saying we've created a new type of film, the truly authentic action film.
Did they take the glass out of the window?
No, James Cameron wasn't present. That sentence by itself upsets me. But then they went on to say that the movie is based on, you know, a series, they listen to stories and series of acts of valor. And it's just all these things. And then they're like, and then we strung them together with a, you know, a conflict to make it a global thing. And it's just, and like, it's not really authentic. The question, authentic is a weird word to break down, but like, they're talking about it's just the most realistic thing you can possibly experience. And, but the problem is they're doing all these things that really happened and then tying them in together with this giant big action save the world plot, which is totally fiction.
Yeah.
And you know, they talk a lot about how they put people right in the middle of the raids, like they have a helmet cam that they show, and they do use a lot of handheld cinematography from what I've seen and promos and stuff, and it just upsets me a lot. And not even that, like, a propaganda movie is bothersome, but that they're acting like this is a real thing.
Yeah.
And people are gonna take it like dumb people are gonna see this and be like, I want to be Army, you know, like. And how, like, in general, how do you feel about this movie's existence, you know?
Act of Valor.
Yeah,
I'm excited now. Okay. I only found out about this like 2 weeks ago. Oh. And it sounds wild.
I don't know. And
can I say something about the
I'm certain it's going to be racist somehow, you know, like, it's going to be like the villain. There's no way.
It's
like
a turban bomb.
Exactly.
We have to get to it.
No, and
I'm going to go off on Ramadan. What does this mean? This is all vaguely somehow racist.
They're celebrating their Roms and Doms, whatever that is. But I'm certain the villain's not going to be white. I'm certain he's going to have an accent. The trailer looks basically like The Expendables, but produced
less
by the
funny
government. Yeah, yeah, exactly.
We don't need that when we have The Expendables coming out.
Mm. Well, yeah, The Expendables 2. Who knows what The Expendables 2 is about? Yeah.
Can I say something quick about fake things and otherwise real things?
Yeah, well, that's what I'm talking about. Like, at what point does talking about something like it's real become bad for you as a person? Like, when William Friedkin is talking about this case, like, oh no, it was just an impression. Like, when does that become bad for you as a person, when you're doing these things, where you're creating things and you're just playing fast and loose with the truth, but talking like it is the truth and then sort of backing out? That's a question.
Yeah, there. I don't know. That's a tough question. What I was going to mention was the hurricane, the
Reuben Carter
one. And can't believe I forget this guy's name. He's one of those that guys. Who's the super racist cop in this one?
In this movie?
No, in the Hurricane.
I never saw Hurricane.
Oh, okay. So Hurricane, based on a true story.
Yeah.
But there. Oh, okay, that's why I don't understand. Okay, so there's the super duper racist cop in Hurricane who picks up Reuben Carter when he's a kid and is like, "Oh, I'm gonna get you, boy." Like, yeah.
Okay. I hope this ends with you telling me that he is eventually arrested by the same cop. Are you serious?
Yeah. Okay, I may be making part of this up, but I know that there's absolutely a super racist fictional character inside the, like, the real story of him.
Yeah.
And I get that, you know, it is a movie and that sometimes you need to take shortcuts and throw a bunch of characters together to speed up the action or whatever, but it was just one of those things where I think part of the point of that movie was like, look how racist these times were.
Yeah.
And then when you do that and then you have to make things up about how racist these times were, it's just, I don't know, it seems really counterproductive to me and silly.
That's fair.
That's just what I was thinking about when you were talking about.
Okay, that's fine.
That.
And I guess like, because I mean, we seem to be in a world where it's getting easier and easier to sort of make up your own reality and sort of valiantly stick by it. Opinions are opinions now and you have to take them seriously.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I see what you mean, where you're coming from. I think it's really tough to draw the line. And yeah, with Acts of Valor, because it's a propaganda thing, I think it makes it particularly touchy subject and sticky ground.
That's my other question. When does it become bad for society?
Yeah, yeah.
Because I don't, I think as a whole, like so many people doing that, playing fast and loose with the truth is generally bad.
Yeah.
I think as much as I love these movies with this sort of handheld style, I think it's probably not great for society in the long run, as subtle as that might be, but just sort of people thinking that the Bourne movies actually happened, you know, or something like that. That's bad to me.
Yeah, and you think, okay, what is the tangible negative outcome of misrepresenting the truth in the French Connection? And, you know, it's hard to... It's a slippery slope.
That's basically the thing I'm saying. And this is a quote that I thought of just because it's in two of my favorite books and I think about it often because it's awesome. But it's from like this New York Magazine story by like Ron Suskin in 2004. And he's talking, it's about Bush administration and stuff like that. And I think I've brought this up on a podcast before. He's like we're an empire, in this Bush aide is talking about, you know, the country, we're an empire now, and when we act we create our own reality, and while you're studying that reality judiciously as you will act again, creating other new realities which you can study too, and that's how things will sort out. We're history's actors, and you, all of you, will be left to just study what we do. And he's talking like from the position of the administration that he was a part of, and
the position of making me pee my pants in fear.
Yeah, exactly.
That's terrible.
And I mean, he was basically arguing with a journalist in that, and it's just like I don't know. It's just there is no real set truth anymore, and that someone in the government is saying things like that is troubling me. And I'm just sort of like, I don't want my favorite type of filmmaking to just stop existing because like I love it. And,
yeah,
but I don't know. I don't know that it. I don't know.
Well, thank you for listening to our 100th episode.
You're welcome.
thank you for occasionally chiming in, James.
You're not welcome.
Okay. I'm sorry that I'm a horrible host. Good news is you have to wait another 100 episodes before we do one of these again.
I thought we did them every 50.
We did the first one at 50 because I don't know that we thought we would get to 100, but here we are.
It only took, what, like 2 years?
Pretty close. Like 23 months. So 1 month short. We did a couple election week specials too, for one. But thank you for listening to the MacGuffin Men. Please continue to listen to the MacGuffin Men. Again, our next podcast will be about Skyfall. We've got some interesting things coming up over the next few months. We're going to do an auteur podcast on Quentin Tarantino, which should be an easy sell to most people. And we've got a lot of other interesting things coming up that I can't remember off the top of my head right now. Because again, horrible radio host.
Quick note about the upcoming Skyfall podcast.
Yeah.
You're going to be right.
Oh, okay. I was really expecting you to sing the Skyfall theme again.
Okay, you're wrong then.
Okay. anyway, please continue to listen to us. And our next podcast won't be so masturbatory, I promise. Thanks for listening.
I don't promise.
Thanks for listening to The MacGuffin Men. Be sure to check out themacguffinmen.com for supplementary links, articles, and more. Thanks for listening.
I think we should probably real quick address, because I mean, we talked about Roman Polanski, his wife's murder. You know, that doesn't entirely get him off the hook for raping a 13-year-old.
No, it doesn't.
And this is something that, you know, when I've talked about this movie in the past, I mean, the most famous thing about Roman Polanski for most people is this rape case.
Yeah.
And
I think if you ask most people our age, like, name something about Roman Polanski,
mm-hmm.
it's rape, director, and then maybe something he directed.
Yeah, cameo in the 2011 film that nobody saw called Carnage. no, it's, I mean, I certainly am not going to defend it, but it's sort of, I don't know, it's weird. And, I mean, we can't sort of, we promote way too much sort of looking at the artist and their art together, and I still think, like, that's, you know, the person that made Chinatown had the potential to do this and then did do it, you know? I'm not, you know, looking for these things when I watch Chinatown, but the fact remains that, you know, he did do these things 3 years later, I think, at 77. Well, but it's... Sorry, continue.
No, go ahead.
No, I wasn't leading in anything.
So I've been researching this whole scenario.
Mm-hmm.
And when I heard Sex Scandal and that he was charged for, you know, raping an underage girl.
Yeah.
Maybe this is me just giving someone the benefit of the doubt, but I just assumed she was like 17 or 18
mm-hmm.
and, you know, maybe looked a little older or lied to him or something.
Yeah.
She was 13 years old.
Yeah, no, 13's pushing it for sure. And I think he drugged her.
Pushing it?
No, sorry.
No, it's pushed. It's fallen over.
Sorry, you know what I mean.
Never getting back.
Sorry, my bad. but, you know, and he drugged her as well, I think, so.
And before this, a year before, he was dating a 15-year-old.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know.
And I mean, like, he... In general, like, all of his relationships, I think, have been with people much younger than him. Like, he's currently married to somebody who's 30-plus years younger than him. So, I mean, that's socially acceptable now because he's 73 or 78. But, yeah. No, and
yeah, just all these actors coming to his defense because he's an artist or a filmmaker or involved in the same industry that they are.
Yeah.
How do you feel about that?
I don't know. Like, I don't know. Again, you know, we've sort of discussed the whole thing in like a very broad sense. I don't know, feel like I know the details of everything. I feel like if you know a person, then it's saying he's an artist is not a good defense, in my opinion.
No, it's really not.
He's an artist. He murdered somebody. He's an artist. It's fine.
Yeah.
But no, it's just sort of, you know, that's not a good enough defense. I feel like maybe if you know a person and you're like, oh, he made the, like, this terrible mistake, you know, which is like an understatement to say the least. But I don't know. It becomes different when you know the person because you're better able to justify things when you know other things about the person. Like we said, he is a film director. He has directed a movie I like a lot, but he has also raped a 13-year-old. So.
Yeah.
And it's just like,
I feel like that doesn't justify it for me.
No. But I mean, you still like Chinatown, you know, like you can enjoy Chinatown away from it. Right.
Yeah. And that's,
as I can, you know?
Yeah, and that's a different issue. To come to the defense of his person is different than saying his work shouldn't be banished for it.
Yeah. No.
I mean, Wagner, the composer, was pretty pro-Nazi. And he was a talented composer, and I don't think those things are mutually exclusive.
Yeah.
If we want to ignore all the art created by anyone who, you know, committed a crime, then I think that's silly.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, there's kind of a revisionist history where, you know, going back to kind of the American-Americana thing, slavery.
Yeah.
I mean, presidents and politicians for the first, I don't know, 100 years, they didn't have a problem with that. Benjamin Franklin enjoyed raping his slaves.
Yep.
I don't think that negates everything he ever said or did. No, and I think you can separate the two of them and enjoy or appreciate what somebody did beyond their morality or things like that. But what we saw with these people coming to the defense of Roman Polanski wasn't, it was not people saying, you know what, everybody, hey, stop hating Chinatown because he did this. It was, hey, let's forgive this guy and allow him to come back to America.
Okay.
And that's a separate issue entirely.
Yeah. Well, I guess it was sort of something that, because I mean, it's easier to talk about this, the Roman Polanski thing, because it's so far in the past. And I think sort of the reason I was thinking about this more with in conjunction with Chinatown is sort of the way people have reacted to Chris Brown's latest album release has been really interesting. Like, now, again, I want to preface this with I do not in any way, am not in any way okay with the fact that Chris Brown, you know, hit a woman quite, you know, intensely. But like a lot of reviews I've been reading, or I mean, I've seen specifically two, and I'm sure that's not all of them, that have just sort of been, he hit a woman, his music is invalid. And just sort of, again, not a defense of Chris Brown's actions, nor his music. But it's just sort of like, I just remember the last line was no stars ever. And I was just wondering if, I don't know, I was wondering if that's just inherent, if that's inherently bad criticism, or if it needs to be said, because it felt more, it always feels like more of a soapbox at that point, you know?
Yeah, no, and I understand that, and it's tough. And what I was thinking about was, you know, from, you know, the Rihanna perspective, was people were saying like, oh, well, you're a role model. If you're going to get back together, if you're basically telling, you know, young women, oh, guys can hit you and that's fine. And that, you know, it puts her in a tough spot. And, you know, obviously I can't speak from her perspective at all, but, you know, it's, it can't be easy to, you know, have everybody's opinions. I'm not saying everybody looks to Rihanna for moral judgment and things like that, but, you know, there are people who do look up to her.
Yeah, exactly. Like, you know
what she did, but it shouldn't be, you know, her place to say everything I do